Hey everybody, welcome to the Energy Matters podcast. Great guest with us today, Miranda McPherson. She is a spiritual teacher, author, and has this beautiful book that I've been reading, The Way of Grace, which we're going to talk about. So welcome, Miranda. So good to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We were just laughing hysterically right as we were about to start because you said Om Namah Shivaya and Cody said, "What is that?" So, we need to just start by maybe you having explaining to us what that is, or to Cody.
Sure.
I'm going to pretend I know.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a mukti mantra from the Sanskrit tradition. Mukti means liberation. So it's a mantra that helps liberate our consciousness. And there are many different like nuances of what it means. But the one that I like the best is that it means I bow to the absolute, to our divine, original, true nature. And may we merge our awareness back into the source of our being, and may everything be liberated and transformed.
Mm. Mm. Lovely. And Cody, now you know.
Now I know. That goes along with like namaste, which, you know, it, depending on which yoga class you go to, there are many different versions of what that means that I have heard. What is your, Miranda, what would you say? What's the one that you like of? If you say namaste to someone, what are you saying to them?
Oh, just the divine in me acknowledges and recognizes and bows to the divine in you. And in that bowing, the me and the you dissolves. Hmm.
So we get to that point of oneness.
Right.
Through that. Yeah. I like that.
And so Miranda, you teach, I guess your teachings would be non-dual in nature, right? You teach.
They are. But I would say it's a very feminine and integrated, holistic approach to the non-duality. So it acknowledges that both the relative aspects of our human being, that we're all on a path of learning and growing and letting go and unfolding our true nature. And yet at the same time, we're already that. You know, we are already whole and perfect and complete. And so you see this understanding in a lot of the deeper mystical traditions of the world that I think Suzuki Roshi said, you know, we're all perfect and we could all do with a bit of work.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah. And it's, you do have this feminine approach to non-duality because I noticed when I lived in India, and I think me and you have been to some of the same places like Ramana Maharshi's ashram in Tiruvannamalai in South India. Beautiful, beautiful place. But I noticed studying Vedanta and some non-dual teachings in India that it was very masculine.
Oh, like, yeah.
Like, This is the truth. You awaken to the truth and then you're done. And don't you have any feelings about it?
Yeah, I don't subscribe to that point of view. You know, I appreciate the rigor and the dedication and the cutting through of that. But I think it's half the picture and that it can very easily be presented in a way that's very annihilating to our humanity and that can lend itself, if we're not careful, to grade A level bypassing, which I think doesn't really serve us to, you know, to really live the truth fully in our daily lives. And when you really look at the lives of some of the great non-dual masters like Ramana Maharshi, who's my Satguru, Nisargadatta, and some of the others, if you really read some of the stories of how they actually were, there's so many beautiful stories about Ramana saying to Papaji, for example, you know, don't you have family in India? It was just at the time of partition. And, you know, aren't they potentially in danger? And apparently Papaji said something like, yes, but it doesn't matter. Nothing's real anyway. A classic, what I call Advaita babble answer. Mm-hmm. And Ramana says, yeah, if it doesn't matter, you get on the next train, you'll go take care of them, make sure that they're safe. Mm-hmm. You know,
for those who are listening, can you just explain who Ramana is?
No.
For those who have never heard of who he is.
Right. Ramana Maharshi was a beautiful sage in South India who was alive in the earlier part of the last century. He died in 1950. He's regarded as one of the purest that India has really brought forth and has inspired millions of people, and including, you know, great minds of the West like Carl Jung. And you can look him up on the internet. And when you see a photograph of his face, it kind of says it all. There's such a radiant transmission And he was famous for bringing everything back to the question, who am I? Which is really the question that all deep spiritual teachings ask us to really journey into ultimately. Who am I really? And it's so he was famous for inviting us to come back into that question and to surrender unreservedly into the question mark within that question and to, you know, really walk the direct path in wholeness and freedom.
That's beautiful. I think one of the things I love Ramana said was one of the greatest services you can render the world is your own self-realization.
Yeah.
Because we live in a world where everyone just wants to change the outside so much, so badly, just change it. And so few people go, well, what if I, then so few people look inwards and go, what if I shift myself first? Then what will happen to the world? I think that was one of his greatest gifts to the world was, hey, focus on your self-realization first and then see what happens to the world.
Right. And not only that, but when we do, as he said, you know, let the thinking, doing mind, the sense of being a separate self, really drop into the vast, open, spacious, loving awareness of the heart, then, you know, what happens naturally is we become more noble, beautiful people. It's very natural to help out, to be caring and kind in the way you go about your daily business. And when the sense of separation falls away, you naturally act in ways that are responsible and pure and noble and beautiful. And that translates to doing your part for, you know, the environment. It translates as just being kinder, you know, as you go to the supermarket and being less self-centered.
So you don't have to wrestle yourself into being a good person.
No, I'm not into helping people be good spiritual boys and girls, nor fake it till you make it. Yeah. I'm more interested in helping people, you know, just come to recognize the truth and the beauty of who they always really are. And then to find the practices that really support the flourishing of that in our lives and the living of it fully in our relationships, at our work, as we're tackling emails, as we're driving, the whole thing.
You know what David just a minute ago talked about, the non-duality teaching being male in some way, like of trying to just, I guess, do a process and then just ignore the rest and kind of push that out in a way. There, I see that in a lot of spirituality, and I don't know that it has to do with this origin, where we kind of go to war with our emotions, with our body, or the teaching creates that. And so it creates this kind of inner battle to overcome or get rid of certain aspects of self. And of course, what David and I teach is more about recognizing that interconnection is a relationship to kind of nurture, and that ultimately it's about integration.
Absolutely.
But you do a lot of work about ego, and that's a place where I really see that battle like come into, like, that's everybody's idea, is I have to get rid of the ego.
Right.
And that creates this inner tension, inner battle.
I call it a spiritual struggle.
Yes, okay.
It creates a spiritual struggle. Creates, you know, so we can, obviously, we all know from our own experience, anyone who's on a real spiritual path knows that it isn't easy. You know, things mm-hmm. come up and, you know, we have to face our self-centeredness. We have to face our fear. We have to learn to relinquish control. We have to let go of judgment. You know, that sounds really easy, but anyone who's actually engaged in it knows that it's not. You know, just to let go of one egocentric habit or behavior is a very big deal. And I think that's because it was all laid down in the years between 0 and 5 and then became just our automatic kind of way of navigating life. And, you know, we're attached to what we know. And so to truly let go of those patterns that definitely make us clunkier and dense than we need to be, you know, requires a lot of things. It requires kindness. It requires willingness. It requires compassion. It requires dedication. It requires curiosity. But it's challenging. And so, you know, the last thing we need is to beat ourselves up in a process that's already challenging.
Right.
But that's what I see a lot of people doing, and they're really misunderstanding the teachings. But I think some of that misunderstanding has been somehow impacted by the fact that up until very recently, pretty much all spiritual teachers, East and West, have been given through the masculine lens only. And so, you know, there's a tendency for this whole process of awakening to become a little too hard line, a little lacking in compassion for our humanity, a little lacking in, you know, self-kindness and the nurturing that's required, because it is so vulnerable to actually let go of what we think we are and what we think we know and how we've been doing things. So I talk about it a lot as, you know, it's not a process of ego annihilation. It's really a process of ego relaxation, learning to relax the ego. And, you know, that's actually, I find, way more efficient.
Right.
You know, it's more potent, it's kinder, it's more compassionate, and it's more helpful to us in the long run. Just like, you know, when we go to the, you know, the animal shelter and we want a new little putty tad or a dog, and, you know, that dog might not have had such a good time in its previous incarnation and it's scared of humans. You can't force that animal to trust you and to feel safe. You know, you have to be kind and gentle and patient with it. And then it kind of opens up to you. And I think that's true. You know, our ego represents our suffering, our confusion, our hurt, our fear. And that's going to let go a lot more easily when there's kindness in the predominant view of things.
And you talk a lot about that in your book. I was reading pieces of it and it's just really beautiful. And you give some amazing guided meditations and inquiries in your book, which I thought was fascinating, that you could, while you're reading, start to inquire into yourself. And it does, Miranda, have this very like nice, soft approach. Mm-hmm. And like I was taught by mostly women. So mm-hmm. India was men, but then when I lived in Hawaii, and I was taught by mostly women, and wow, there was such another dimension that opened up to me. I was like, process emotion and energy and be sensitive to how I feel. What? I thought I was supposed to take the sword of discretion and just chop my ego's head off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lucky you that you got to experience that. And I mean, the feminine is really all about embodiment. Mm-hmm. You know? And in a way, when you look at, you know, what does a female body do? You know, she opens up in ecstasy and allows new life to seed itself in her. And then there's the natural intelligence that's really all about bringing that into form and nurturing it, the innate love and wisdom to help that new being kind of flourish and thrive. And so the feminine aspect is really about, you know, how do we help things flourish and thrive into embodiment in the practical? And we need the both. We do need the rigor. We do need the discipline. The more, let's say, masculine aspects, those things are important, you know. But at the same time, we need the compassion and the mercy and the love and the kindness in order for our deepest nature to reign supreme in our life and in our experience. So, yeah.
Could we talk about a cave in India for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
So, you were in India near Ramana Maharshi's ashram, and I believe in the same cave that he was meditating in and had his realization in. Is that right?
Well, he actually had his awakening when he was 16 years old.
That's right, yeah.
And so it was after that huge realization that he had that he got on a bus and went to Tiruvannamalai, which is a bit like what Lourdes is to Catholics. You know, this ancient temple town in South India is to devotees of Shiva. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, you know, he found his way up the mountain and lived in two caves for about 15 years. And so it was in one of those caves that I had a very profound experience that completely changed the course of my inner spiritual life and also my personal life too, and my way of teaching. And so I think what I'd like to say before we get to that is that prior to that moment, I was already, you know, an interfaith minister. I was spiritual director of a groundbreaking interfaith seminary in London. And I've been guiding other people, close to 600 actually, to become interfaith ministers and spiritual counselors. I've created the curriculum. So I say that in that you know, I had a lot of spiritual concepts and a lot of spiritual training, and my life was already devoted to truth and to serving others, and I wasn't looking for anything new.
Mm-hmm. What, can I just jump in with that? What was that curriculum or that interfaith idea grounded in? Was it in a metaphysical kind of viewpoint or?
Well, it was grounded in the idea that at the core of all the world's great wisdom tradition, there are universal principles and truths, mm-hmm. and that ultimately the divine or God, to use that term, is one, but there are many paths, and that all authentic paths that purify the human heart of hurt, fear, hate, greed, have validity. Uh-huh. And have something to teach us about how human beings transform and live the truth. So I'd created a curriculum based on the practices that each of these traditions offer to us about how human beings transform. And the training then became, you know, one of how do we hold space for people in a non-denominational context, understand enough about where they might have come from spiritually. But how do we serve the unchurched people, the people who would call themselves spiritual but not necessarily religious?
Right. Nice.
Yeah, it was beautiful. And it still goes today. It's called the One Spirit Interfaith Foundation in London.
Oh,
and
there's lovely.
A sister school in New York City, so it's still going. So that's what I was doing before right. this moment in the cave. So it's important to say that because I think that too often, you know, awakening is presented as if you have just have a big spiritual orgasm and then that just happened out of nowhere and then that's it. And I think right. that isn't so kind to people because when you really look at awakenings, there's usually a big backstory of years of dedicated, sincere inquiry and practice that's gone on. And that was true for me.
Hmm. Yeah. And so you went into this cave
yeah.
and you sat to meditate. Uh-huh. And what unfolded from there?
Well, I disappeared. Everything disappeared. Everything I thought, and any concept of I, God, other, world, it just went poof, stopped. So I heard inwardly, although it wasn't a voice per se, but I heard, received a transmission that said, be nothing, do nothing, get nothing, become nothing, seek for nothing. Relinquish nothing. Be as you are. Rest in God. Mm. And it was an indescribable silence and cessation of any kind of thought. And it was utter peace, utter stillness, utter completeness. And I was that. You know, I was that.
And from there, you got the message to go west.
No, I was in that state for 3 weeks continuously.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was revelatory because I had been feeling something new knocking on the inner door of my meditation practice for about 2 years prior to this. And now I kind of understood what it was. And I realized that my big fear of that level of surrender was concerned that I might just sort of dissolve into this puddle of goop on the floor and I wouldn't be able to function or hold an organization together or do anything and just be useless. And in those 3 weeks where there was no thoughts whatsoever, there was no commentary, there was no I, there was no other, there was no God, there was, you know, it was all just everything as it was, I felt so natural. It was like the most natural thing in the world. And doing ordinary stuff, crossing the road, eating, having a conversation, any task that needed to be done, it was so much easier without the filter of a me. Mm-hmm. So natural. Everything was so direct. And so I came back to England. And then after that 3 week period, there was a shift where more, what I call more ordinary awareness came back. But at the same time, the ground, I'll say, the kind of the knowing, the wisdom from this experience didn't change. So there was the both. There was the this that was, you know, nothing, no one, total peace, total being. And then also Miranda, the personality with all her tendencies and habits and so forth, was also there. And I heard when that happened, now integrate it. And that was really beautiful and I think really important, because I already knew that, you know, true realization isn't state dependent. All states come and go, even really beautiful ones. And that the important thing isn't that we hold on to any particular state. The important thing is that we relate to these expanded states when they come as the true teacher, as the inner guru. And we let those states teach us how it really is and how to really live and how to really be real. And so that set in motion a really enormous process that took me into a very new kind of life. And the first thing that started happening was all of the structures of life as I knew it, all the things that held together Miranda, the person of Miranda, started to disappear, and rapidly, without me having any say in it. My marriage of 12 years started to fall apart, and it had been a good marriage. The work with the Interfaith Seminary, I mean, here I was leading other people to become ministers, and I didn't know what I believed in anymore. I didn't even want to talk to, I didn't want to speak. All I wanted to do was be quiet for a while. So it was kind of tricky. I felt like I had to reconfigure myself back into how I used to be in order to teach that, and or else take the whole seminary apart and rearrange it around what I now understood. It was very clear that that wasn't what was wanted. So that came to a conclusion. I was very identified with my role as spiritual director of the Interfaith Seminary. So all these things that were part of my identity just started literally giving way. It was a huge experience and very unnerving. I felt like this great hand was sweeping across the chessboard of my life, knocking all the pieces to floor and then tearing up the chessboard. Hmm. I knew that the thing to do was just to say yes to it, just to let it happen. But as I said earlier, you know, it's one thing knowing something, and it's another thing having the courage to go there, to let it happen.
Right.
You know, and so I knew that was the work. And so it was about a 2-year period of undoing, and there wasn't anything it didn't touch, including the country I lived in. I lost, you know, pretty much all my friends. It was huge. Mm. But at the same time, I came alive like never before. It was very profound.
Was that undoing the integration, or after the undoing, is that when you really started to be able to unpack and integrate it?
Yeah, there were several phases.
Yeah.
So there was first what I call the period of the undoing. Mm-hmm. And it was really helpful. I came across a metaphor that Adyashanti used. That really helped me.
He's one of my favorite teachers.
Oh, I think he's one of everyone's favorite teachers.
Yeah.
He said that just like the stark of beauty, that winter time when everything is pruned back is also beautiful. It's a different kind of beauty than the spring. Mm-hmm. You know, it felt like, oh, here this is. This is the spiritual winter of my life. Open to it. Open to the beauty of everything being stripped right back. Allow it. And so that meant for me, you know, opening and allowing, like, you know, not having a home for a while, you know, allowing the letting go of everything that was familiar, all my reference points, and learning to relax into a level of vulnerability that felt like I had no skin for a while. And to cherish what that gave me, and that gave me tremendous access to a depth of clarity and guidance and grace that I just hadn't known before. It was immense. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn then to live from that and to integrate it. And the integration took about another further 2 years. Mm-hmm. And in that integration, I saw a lot about how we allow deep realization to stabilize and become our inner platform, our new normal, and what human beings really need in order to truly shift the center of gravity and let that be useful practically in the way that is they live. So a whole body of teachings started to emerge And those body of teachings make up the curriculum that I call the way of grace and the methodology of ego relaxation.
Mm-hmm. That's really great.
Can you tell us a little bit more about ego relaxation?
Sure. Well, ego relaxation is simultaneously a transmission, like be nothing. When you really just like, don't even try with your mind, but you just open to this transmission to be nothing, do nothing, get nothing, become nothing, seek for nothing, relinquish nothing, be as you are, rest in God. It has the capacity, if we open to it, to just bring you back to that zero point, that your original natural condition. Because when you think of it, your ego, your familiar identity, is always trying to be somebody impressive, you know, successful, useful, lovable, good enough. It's always trying to become some version of what we think the ideal is. It's always trying to get something, you know, we're trying to be this and become that so that in the hope that we might get love or get peace or get freedom. But of course, it's that seeking and trying and efforting that is actually blocking the direct natural experience of qualities that you actually are. You know, we get on a spiritual path and we think we need to relinquish all these bad habits, amputate the stuff that we think shouldn't be there, right? So you can see that all the being, doing, trying, getting, becoming, it represents our ego activity, the ways in which we are unconsciously just picking up again and again those tendencies and habits that make us less graceful than we can be, and that all of it can in an instant just come to rest if we allow ourselves to be exactly as we are, exactly, and it to rest in God. When that happens, you realize it's all happening within God anyway, even your ego. So never fear. It's okay, right? And so we can open to that as a transmission in a moment, and it's like this reset. We come home to ourselves. But it's also an ongoing practice for life. So to relax your ego, first you have to become aware of the tendencies of your ego, what they are for you. Some people, their ego has a lot more fear and anxiety in it. And so we need to see that, bring that to the light of awareness, understand what that's based in, and to just learn to relax in and through the fear and to see what's deeper than our fear. Some ego structures, you know, mine had a lot more control in it, a lot more push, a lot more efforting in it. And I can look back to my, you know, childhood history and I can kind of see exactly why. But nevertheless, you know, for me personally, learning to let go of control and ego efforting, that kind of pushing for your ego to get things done, has been much more work than it might be for other people. Well, for some of us, you know, there's a lot of anger, you know, and we fixate a lot around anger and righteousness and, you know, so some of us, it's like there's a lot of judgment, either of self or of other. I mean, everyone has judgment, but, you know, so these represent dense features of our ego. And then there's our personal history and the hurts and the heartbreaks that we haven't quite fully emerged from, the little micro and macro traumas that need to be contacted with ego relaxation, which means going towards it, right, energetically, in body, heart, mind, somatically, with our heart and with our awareness to really understand what is this and not to judge it, but just to contact it and be there and do nothing. And there's something miraculous that happens when we go towards anything egoic and we be there fully in body, heart, mind, and we feel it and do nothing, that grace comes alive. It's grace that transforms us, that dissolves our obstacles, that parts the seas of our consciousness, and that helps us to truly walk across the shore to the promised land of freedom that is our birthright.
So let's talk about grace, because that's the title of your book.
Yeah. Can
you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by grace and how somebody can open up to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, grace, I mean, it's such a beautiful word for starters, and it brings a lot of connotations, brings the felt sense of ease, of inspiration, of deep connectedness with what really is, you know. And but really, when I say the word grace, what I mean is direct experience of the divine presence. And when we open, when we feel that direct experience, the kiss of the divine upon our mind, heart, and body, what happens is all our essential qualities come back online. The love that we are, the peace that we are, the joy that is our deepest nature, the intelligence, the strength, the clarity, the wisdom, all these divine qualities come alive from within us. And so, you know, I've made a real study of grace because it's, you know, very clear to me that to really walk a true spiritual path, we need a lot of help. Rumi said that. He said, you know, give up to grace. You need a lot more help than you know. And that's true. We do. We need all help we can get. And so I've seen that there really are four dimensions to grace. There's the what I call the ground of grace, the fact that, you know, something, call it what you will, causes everything to be, right? Something causes the earth to unfold. Something causes the trees to compassionately suck in our carbon dioxide and give us back clean oxygen, right? Something causes a sperm and an egg to ignite and to start forming into a human being. Something causes the sun to rise and set every day, you know? So when you really hang out, for example, in the wilderness, in nature that isn't manipulated by human hands, or you really reflect deeply on what causes you and I and everything and everyone to be here at all, we see that there is this primordial ground of grace that is the foundation of everything. And that's important when we recognize that, you know, there's nothing but grace really in the depths of things. It's much easier to relax. It's much easier to surrender because there's something to surrender into, you know. So that's the first dimension of grace. And the second dimension of grace really is the loving presence, the blessings that arrive mysteriously in our life, often in very beautiful and surprising but very personal ways to help us to grow and open and heal and thrive. And that kind of dimension of grace has a feeling to it as if like we're in a cosmic shower of divine light, and that light and loving goodness pervades us and helps us. And so this is where, and maybe, you know, Cody, I think I've heard you talk a lot about, you know, working with guides and so forth, you know. So this relates to the blessings of grace and their practices that I give about, you know, opening to a hand of light upon your crown and seeing, you know, whether that belongs to a being of light that you know, and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, when you really study deep mystical traditions, even those who don't believe in like a supreme being, for example, Tibetan Buddhism, within that cosmology, there are countless practices they give that are about opening up to receive the beneficent blessings of the bodhisattvas. And so the blessings of grace helps us open to, you know, receive the grace of enlightened beings, receive love, receive what we need to heal, receive guidance, and really help us to be nourished deeply on an inner level. And there are practices that I lead people in and teachings and inquiries that help us to become more awake to that. Mostly it's to do with cultivating, you know, the virtues like trust and humility and patience and joy. And then there's the transforming power of grace, recognizing that you and I, our ego doesn't do spiritual transformation. Grace does. So how do we open to the transforming power of grace that has the capacity to help us to truly heal from betrayal and heartbreak and the really tough things that we all go through as human beings? How does that help us to become more compassionate, more noble? How does that help us to truly shift out of those stories of the past the sense of being not good enough in some way? And how does that transforming power of grace help us to truly cross over to the other shore into our true identity? And so this is a big part of the work, is opening to the transforming power of grace. And then the last dimension of grace is, you know, living the embodiment of it, being a grace delivery device. And I believe and see that, you know, our bodies, our hearts, our minds are much more than we think they are. They really are a portal, a delivery device for the most beautiful, noble, divine attributes and qualities to pour forth from us into our world, to heal and hydrate and bless this tired and parched earth that could surely do with more human beings being graceful, grounded in what is real and capable of responding wisely to the personal and the collective challenges that we find.
And so somebody's listening to this, Miranda, and first of all, thank you for that beautiful description of grace, all three parts. So somebody's listening to this and they're like, where do I start?
Yeah.
I feel resistance, not grace.
Yeah. Right. Life is resistance.
Yeah. So the beautiful thing is the gate to grace is always right where you are. And so where we always start is, okay, where are you right now? What is your direct experience? If you let go of thinking about where you should be or where you'd like to be, the gate to grace starts with opening, softening, allowing your experience to be exactly as it is. So I give a question in the very first chapter where we're laying the foundations of ego relaxation as a practice, and it is this: what's it like in body, heart, mind, if you just open, soften, and allow your experience to be exactly as it is? So these three words, what's it like, are very beautiful. And you'll notice if you read my book that I use them a lot, because they're just a gentle encouragement to explore your experience, to lean into your experience, and to just see what it is with complete openness, somatically, emotionally, and in your awareness, and allow it. Because that what that does is it melts resistance, for starters, and it helps you become more intimate with yourself, with what's actually here. And that's what's always going to bring about a natural yielding, a natural surrender. And it's always yielding, surrender, relaxation that makes us receptive to the presence of grace, whether it comes as a reminder of our true ground, of what's always holding us, whether it comes to us as an insight or a felt sense of love that helps us, whether it comes to us as something that transforms and dissolves, or whether it just helps us to become more noble and real. Mm. It's all good.
Yeah. Mm. Your experience in the cave, do you feel like you just stepped into that space of grace all at once, and that was like this, what you were immersed in? Is that what you would call it, that? Or was it something a little different? Did that come out of it?
Yeah, it was. I wasn't expecting anything, Cody. I was just, frankly, I was a little burnt out, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, it's really paradoxical. Often when we're not trying to get anywhere particular,
yes,
we're actually most receptive. And that was certainly the case for me that day. And, you know, it really just was grace. You know, I sat down on a dusty old cushion. It was seriously hot, over 100 degrees, you know, in South India, you know, human heat.
Right.
You could hardly breathe, but it was like a disappearing.
Right. You couldn't expect it, but you've stepped into a direct space or connection of grace,
right,
that maybe wasn't something you could have mentally created before that experience.
I couldn't, although I had, you know, again, I had been meditating and praying for years, you know, for help in opening to true realization. And I'd been meditating for at least an hour and a half every day for at least 15 years prior to that moment. Right. I had been working on the crunchy parts of my personality for rather a long time. You know, prayer and meditation was my central practice at that point. You know, so it was grace. And yet, you know, it's a curious dance, like, between our sincere efforts in any practice and the hand of grace when it comes. You know, mm-hmm. we can't make it happen. We can engage practices. And I love Suzuki Roshi also saying that, you know, enlightenment is a divine accident, but spiritual practice makes one more accident prone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's a good line. Yeah, I love your story, because in our culture of wanting something now and high expectations about everything, there is this paradox in the spiritual practice or pursuit to try to get something.
Right.
And that it should be fast.
Right.
And this took years, right? This is the unfoldment of you as the individual.
That's right.
And I think that I like this part of that paradox, is that you can enter grace into the moment, in the moment, and touch that energy in yourself.
Right.
It doesn't mean the whole world's going to change
right.
and be perfect.
Right.
So I just like hearing that it was a process over time to kind of validate that for everybody.
I talk about that because, again, I think it's really important, because many people, you know, having a realization experience is the easy part.
Right.
Actually living it in life, that is where the work is, integrating it so that, you know, you become a deeper, more graceful, wiser, real human being. And, you know, I love what Ram Dass said once. You know, he said, like, if you want to know where you're at in your realization process, go spend 2 weeks living with your family of origin and you'll find out.
Right.
Right. Yes. So, you know, it's not just what we realize on the cushion in those beautiful moments in meditation where we let go and where something opens up that, you know, changes our experience, but what's the wisdom from that experience? Mm-hmm. And how embodied can that wisdom become? And I think that, you know, it's so, humility is such an important virtue that all the great spiritual traditions have taught, for very good reason, because the deeper you go, the more you see just how very attached you are to, you know, your familiar way of orienting and navigating life, and
right.
you know, how many more defenses you have than you thought.
Yes.
You know,
and that leads me to a question, because it's so easy to pursue a spiritual path and practice, but just add that to your ego.
I know.
So it starts to become a part of those defenses, a part of how you stay separate. How do you deal with that? And how do you kind of, what are your either tools or ideas around how to not become kind of an ego spiritualist?
Oh, yeah. I'm so grateful that you said that. And I agree completely that, you know, even after significant realization, there's just this common tendency for our ego to just go, you know, go, great. Now I've got a spiritually sophisticated toolkit. I can become an even more sort of super spiritual charged version of me.
Right.
No, the whole goal is the relinquishing of you, you know, the relaxing of what you think you are, you know, and letting our true nature shine through. So for me personally, I do a lot to kind of keep it clean. Firstly, I'm married to a really wonderful man who also happens to be a spiritual teacher. Mm-hmm. And we're very real with each other. And we have an agreement of being honest and giving real feedback to one another when we need it. And so that's very helpful. I also have a few handful of good friendships in my life where we have that explicit agreement. I personally go and sit with another spiritual teacher on a regular basis, one-on-one, mm-hmm. whom I give permission to point anything out to me and help me look at anything I need to on a regular basis. I do at least 2, sometimes 3 retreats a year where I'm just another person on the retreat. I'm not the teacher of the retreat. I'm just there plowing the field of my own consciousness and continuing to turn over any rocks. Yeah, as well as engaging my practices on the cushion and elsewhere.
Yeah.
Lovely. And you live in Northern California now.
I do. Yeah.
And are you teaching live classes in?
I do. I run a sangha. It's called the Living Grace Sangha. And these are 2 dedicated sanghas. So people have to apply to be part of it, and they're ongoing groups. Most people have been with me for years. As I really like, I like going deep with people, and I like taking people, you know, as far as we can for the long haul. So they're very beautiful communities. They operate in Marin County, where I live, and one an hour up the road in Sonoma County. And I also teach retreats internationally at, you know, the major centers like Esalen and Omega and Kripalu and so forth, as well as a couple of other private retreats and, you know, all of that. Mm. And in England and Holland and Ireland as well.
Lovely.
Yeah. And then I teach, you know, I have sort of small private practice and work with a few students personally, one-to-one, and try to, you know, spend the rest of my time, you know, generating teaching materials that I can offer online to help people wherever they're based.
Your life sounds like Cody and mine.
Yeah.
Except you do it with so much more grace.
Grace.
You have so much more grace. I'm not joking. Could I just ask about the one-on-one work that you do? So when you sit with somebody as the teacher and they're coming to you, what does that process look like? Are they saying like, Miranda, look, I've got this issue. Can we work on this? Or are they looking for awakening? Or are you helping them integrate? What does that look
like? Well, I have this view that whatever we've got going on, whatever seems to be the issue that people are working with, whether it is, you know, they're caught in some tough spot with a lover or a parent, or they're dealing with something in their career, or whether there's something new arising in their meditation practice, it doesn't really matter where we begin, because it's just the jumping off point. So I invite people to settle here with me, and then to sort of open up something that's important to them that they want my help looking at. And so we go towards it, we open it up. And so we practice ego relaxation, opening, softening, allowing, sensing, feeling, seeing what is that exactly. And we also work firstly with, I call it the what's here, your experience, and then also the who's here, who is the experiencer, who's the identity. And little key is that usually when we're caught in some contraction or some struggle, it's almost always evidence that there's a historically based somebody in the mix. So we need to open that up and let it be seen and understood and felt and healed. And then, you know, we pop through it. So at the basement of everything is who you really are. So it doesn't really matter whether you're presenting me with a relationship issue or a feeling that you're not good enough, or a concern in your career, or some challenge that's arising in your spiritual practice. If we meet it all completely, it is inevitable that we will land in deeper grace. And so for me, this is just such a beautiful process, because I get to see the miraculous nature of the transforming power of grace every day. And I get the joy of having other people discover that for themselves and come to recognize deeply, experientially, who they really are.
Yeah, it's very fulfilling as a teacher, isn't it, to watch somebody develop into themselves?
Yeah, I often joke, I hope I die giving satsang. it's so blissful. I mean, it probably wouldn't be very nice for my students, but for me, it's the best, you know?
You traumatized one student.
I just have a heart attack in the middle of satsang, and I'd just be in total bliss. It really is. It's bliss. For me to just be with somebody and open it all up. It's like I'm in the cave, you know, plus.
Yeah.
Actually. Mm.
When you're kind of resting in that graceful place and working with someone, do you feel that from there you have more intuition and more answers arise, and it's almost this communal, I hate to use the word psychic, but it's a connection, energy connection that
I can
kind of read where they're at.
Yes. Like when someone sits with me, they don't even need to tell me. I can already hear and see it.
Yeah.
But often what they're telling me isn't what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Right. And so I'll receive what they're telling me, of course, but I'm obedient to what it is that's being shown that we really need to open up.
Yes.
And there's a lot of that, what would perhaps classically be called clairvoyance or clairaudience or clairsentience.
Yes.
In the mix only, I don't sort of worry about that or focus on it too much.
It's just there. But I love the way you just said that, because that is the intuitive's dilemma, is you see one thing, but the story a person's stuck in is something different. And how do you get them to the depth of where they need to work without invalidating the story?
Here's how I do it. I ask questions.
Yeah.
So, you know, many years ago, and I don't talk about this much, but I put myself through college, you know, giving clairvoyant readings.
Ah.
You know, it was easier than waitressing. And but I realized early on I wasn't supposed to be using that gift that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be just reassuring people and telling them what to do. I wanted them to be helped to come home to who they really are. And from there, all the clarity and the guidance that they need is available. And so my efforts are always oriented towards what helps that. So when I hear something or I see something that is seemingly not what the person is telling me, I'll receive what they're telling me, but I'll ask a question about what I'm getting that invites them to explore what is this and what is that, or, you know. And so sometimes questions come out of me that seem unrelated to what people are actually saying, but very quickly they are revealed not to be unrelated at all.
Right.
But they help cut through, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
It's beautiful. I've gone through something similar where I used to do a lot of readings, and these days I do just a few. And when I do, I try so much more to focus on helping this person find that answer for themselves.
Absolutely.
Rather than like, oh, there it is. You just need to do that. Go do it.
Well, it's more empowering. And it's also just, you know, I think there's a very big difference between, you know, people going to a reading, and often they're going to a reading because they're frightened and they need reassurance that it'll be okay. Well, there are other ways of helping them to relax and get it actually is okay and it will be okay. So, you know, that's more the way that I like to work on it is, well, let's look at the part of you that doubts. You know, the doubts that you held, the doubts that the flow of life is inherently beneficent, that the forces of your life are trying to move you in the direction of the good, of what will help you really, you know. And there's always a big difference between what we think is going to do it for us and what actually does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for most of us, we all have to work on trust, you know, and that's a big part of opening to grace, actually. It's trust, helping to trust the loving goodness that underlies our life that actually opens us to receive the blessings of grace and receive the grace of divine love that helps us along the way in every way.
Mm-hmm. And you share that beautifully in this book, which if you're watching the show, I'll just share the cover one more time, The Way of Grace, really, really lovely book. And we were talking before we started the show that you can actually listen to the audio book of Sounds True. You did an audio version for Sounds True, where you walk people through the meditations and the inquiries.
The whole thing. I was delighted when I landed in the studio at Sounds True. I was expecting them to say, okay, you know, you can record about 2/3 of the book, which is what's usually done. And they said, no, you're reading the whole thing from beginning to end. And I was just so happy about that because, honestly, it is a very powerful book and it's a very practical book. It's not something you can read in a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
The transmission pours through the book and the practical application pours through the book as well. So it's meant to be read and worked with, you know, for a long period of time. It's a map as well as a transmission and a how. And so it was a great joy to be able to go through all of it, to read all of it, and to take the listener through all the inquiries and all the guided meditations and the prayers. And you know, they even allowed me to create some of my own music behind it, and I'm a musician as well. So it was
that's cool. Beautiful. What do you play?
I play the harmonium and I sing.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's lovely. That's lovely. And it's a beautiful book, and you're a beautiful teacher. And thank you so much for coming to sit with Cody and I and sharing your light and your wisdom. Mm-hmm. And so for anybody listening who wants to find out more about Miranda, you can go to MirandaMcPherson.com. You could pick up the book, The Way of Grace. And this is your third or your fourth book?
It's actually my second.
Oh, second book.
It's my second actual physical book, but I've got other audiobooks.
That's right. That's what I saw.
I've got an audiobook called Meditations on Boundless Love as well.
Lovely. Right. And they can find you in Northern California.
They can find me in Northern California, but I go other places too. So check out my website. That's got the full schedule. I think the next retreat is in North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
Oh, great.
And also at the SAND conference as well. Although,
what's that?
Science and Non-Duality. It's a big non-duality conference coming up in San Jose fairly soon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Everyone who's anyone in that community is there.
Me and Cody are always looking at these conferences like, we got to go to one of these.
You should know. Go to the SAND conference. You'd love it.
Okay. All right. Cool. Let's look. I would love to. Well, Miranda, it was such a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. The time's gone by so quick. So
I know. Yeah. And for everyone listening, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you so much, you guys. And just also for the beautiful work that you do. And really appreciate what you're offering to the wider community.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, in the theme of this episode, namaste to all of you. Divine in us recognizes and sees the divine in you. And thank you so much for listening and being here with us. Have an amazing day. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Miranda.